Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to this Motorsport Magazine issue commentary podcast. Now, the point of these podcasts is to give you, the listener, an understanding of what goes into producing an issue of Motorsport over the 4-week schedule that we have. Now, this podcast, we're focusing on the August 2017 issue of Motorsport, which is on sale now. It's available from the Motorsport Magazine website on our shop. It's available in the USA if you check out Barnes & Noble. And also, it's available as a digital edition. So today, in this commentary, we have Lyndon, who is our staff photographer. Hello, Lyndon.
Hi, Nick.
We have Simon Aaron, who is our features editor. Hello, Simon.
Hi, Nick.
And Joe. How are you, Joe?
Very well, thank you. Can you hear me?
I can hear you very well. You're sat about one foot from me. Right, so Joe is our deputy editor. So we've got a good team here to discuss the ins and outs of the August 2017 issue. Now, what I would recommend is that if you have a copy of the magazine, pause this, go and get it. If you haven't got an issue, then pause this, go to the newsagents and pick one up. Because what we're going to do is we're going to talk through, not page by page because it will take forever, but we're going to talk you through from the cover through to features. And speaking of the cover, let's go straight in. We have Nigel Mansell's FW14B on the cover, but it's not Nigel Mansell's crash helmet here. Joe, whose crash helmet is this?
It's Karim Chantok's helmet, and he has driven the car for us and written about it, and we think it's a world exclusive. It's the first time that Nigel Mansell's championship-winning 1992 car has been driven since 1992, and Karim has driven it for us at Silverstone, written about it, and it makes a very, very strong cover image. I mean, there was some debate because we have two cracking stories in this particular issue, two cracking tests of Formula One cars, and there was a toss up between this image and another one, which Nick, you might want to talk about.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. So we're spoiled for choice really with this one because Karim drove both the FW14B and the latest 2017 F1 Williams at Williams Fan Day at Silverstone, which you may have read about on our website or elsewhere, hopefully our website. We had a bit of an embarrassment of riches. We had the opportunity to put the latest car on the cover, the Martini liveried car, or the FW14B. And we had a good conversation around the office, and Lyndon was involved in this as well. He's shaking his head. He was there.
I was not there. No, it was the day I was off.
Oh, was it really? All right, okay, he wasn't there. So we discussed whether we should put the latest car on the cover or the 14B, but I think in the end, this picture looked great, didn't it? Simon's going to jump in.
It was partly the image, and also we were sort of thinking about, you know, what's the strongest sort of story? What would readers really want to read about? It's obviously a great get to have driven and tested the current 2017 Formula One car. I've certainly never read a proper test of one of those during the season it's competing. But at the same time, you can't get away from the fact that this is Mansell's championship-winning Williams.
Yeah, Red 5. Yeah, it's fabulous.
And also, the photograph was taken at Silverstone, and I think the synergy, not a word I particularly like, but the synergy between Mansell, Williams, Silverstone, Williams having scored his first Grand Prix win at Silverstone, everything is. I just think, and that car, you know, which one, the FW40, successful though it is in relative terms, is very unlikely to be winning at Silverstone this year. I think we accept that. So I just think the package of ingredients on the Mansell cover it was the obvious. It was a difficult choice in many ways, but I still think it was the obvious choice.
Yeah, I think hopefully we made the right call. It's a lovely shot. There's the image. I mean, Lyndon can assess it better than I can, but there's something intriguing about this image. It's not a composed studio shot of this car. It's the car disappearing off out of a garage.
It's watching it being, as it's going out on its maiden run and seeing it appearing and disappearing, shall we say. So, yeah, to capture it as we have, it's it's reminiscent of 92, and it's also current of now.
So how did everyone feel about Karun writing this piece? We know, you know, obviously a very accomplished driver. He's just back from Le Mans. He's a great broadcaster as well. His work on Channel 4 is fantastic. But I'll be absolutely honest, I was really nervous. I mean, I commissioned him, but I was still really nervous. Racing drivers aren't generally the most articulate. But yeah, what do you guys think?
I mean, Karun is articulate. I mean, there are a thing about certain Williams drivers. I mean, many, many moons ago, commissioned Damon Hill to write a motorcycling piece for a magazine. He insisted on doing himself, and it was, you know, it was hardly needed a comma changing. It was brilliant. And Karun's stuff didn't need much work either. It was very, very good. And I mean, he's got a strong association with, I mean, he's the official Williams Heritage Test driver. The fact that they trust him to drive their cars, I think, means we should, you know, we should certainly trust him to drive them for us.
And also, I mean, I think the fact that he is obviously associated with Williams, I mean, you could argue that he's never therefore going to give a sort of dispassionate view of these cars. So, I mean, we should probably stress that, you know, this isn't a sort of a critique of the cars. This is a celebration of the cars. He did it brilliantly, and especially actually with the Mansell car, where he writes very eloquently about being I think he was 10, he'll probably tell me he was younger than that, but as a boy watching Red 5 and knowing about this car, and he said this VHS video is worn out from watching Mansell driving this car, and it was literally a childhood dream come true to get behind the wheel.
You could see the excitement on his face as he was getting in, and he had a Haynes manual for the Williams, and he was just getting everybody to sign it and flicking through it, and it was like you say, seeing a schoolboy dream come true. It was fantastic for him.
Yeah, this being a kind of a behind the scenes podcast as well, I'll mention that I saw him at Le Mans at the drivers parade in the city centre on the Friday. I went to there's a kind of a car park paddock area where the cars and the drivers assemble, and they're, you know, there's a lot of waiting around, and the drivers are talking and gossiping, and some crazy reason they let me in, and I walked up to Karun. I saw him there and said hello, and he was I think he was talking to Ruben, it might have been someone else, but he was showing him the pictures of the day, and all the other drivers going, you drove the 14B, you drove, and he was kind of like, you know, he had this enormous grin on his face. You could tell that it really meant something, and he was doing what probably the rest of us would do if we driven the 14B, we were showing off to our contemporaries, you know.
I think if I'd driven the 14B, I'd probably be in a hospital bed still.
yes, me too. Yeah, well, hopefully you're having a good look at this feature now as we're talking about it. There's a lovely quote about how Karun thought he could hear Murray Walker. You know, he felt like he could almost hear him as he's going down the hangar straight. So we hope we've done a good job with this. It's such an evocative car story. And actually, I kind of see it as a tribute to Williams as well. You know, this is their 40th anniversary, and the fan day was a roaring success from what I can see.
The turnout was incredible, and just seeing everybody there, being able to get close to the cars as well during the lunchtime and whatever else was put on around the circuit, it was, I think, 50,000 people turned up. Friends of mine were phoning me on the day saying, "Are you at Silverstone?" Because they'd only just found out that day and managed to get in. And it was, if they can do it every year, I think this will be something that will be a raging success, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, just your story about Le Mans just reminded me in this piece, he sort of says at the end that as he came back into the pit, there was Mark Webber and Anton Davidson and Ricciardo and Massa. They were all there, and he can't help himself but, you know, just feel quite smug about the fact that he's got to drive this the car and not them.
Fantastic. I'll tell you what, we'll move on because we haven't got much time, but we have got a huge amount of content in this issue. So as a reminder, this is the August 2017 issue of Motorsport Magazine. So check it out. Where should we go to next, chaps? Should we go to the Rover SD1 Triple Treat as it's sold on the contents page? I'll tee this one up because I've been speaking to Dickie about this for a while. So this is Dickie Meaden, our contributing editor, expert, historic racer. He's got an enormous soft spot for these SD1s that are emerging now as real, they're attractions, aren't they? Huge attractions at historic racing around the country and around the world. And he has driven back to back a Group 1, a Group 2, and the ultimate Group A SD1. And I tell you what, that opening shot is pretty cool, I would say. Yeah, it's a great shot. It's a great story. Who wants to jump in and tell me what they think about this this story?
I'll kick off. As I'm old enough to have covered the British Saloon Car Championship in period and actually wrote about Rover SD1s when they were new. I do think one of the things, I know they're not period Goodwood cars, but one of the highlights of the UK racing season for me for the last few years has been the Group 1 recreation race, the Jerry Marshall Trophy they have at the Goodwood members meeting. And there's a very high caliber of driver who takes part in that. And watching Capris, SD1s and such like being hurled around Goodwood is just Dolomite sprints and so on. It's absolutely fantastic. And it's just a lovely reminder of how saloon car racing was back then. I know nowadays it's a lot more competitive. You've got 30 cars in the British Touring Car Championship, of which the top 2024 are covered by a second in qualifying. And back when the Rover was around, it was a class system, so you had, you know, half a dozen Rovers, and then you'd filtered down to much slower cars. But the car's body language back then, the racing's very good in the BTCC today, don't get me wrong, but the car's body language back then was just fabulous. And I think Dickie's done a great job of conveying what all three are like to drive.
Yeah, tell us... he's going to jump in there, Joe.
Well, I was just going to say, just to agree with Simon, that one of the great things that comes out of this piece is seeing Dickie really nails the evolution of the cars as they go through, from Group 1. And because he's such a good driver and sensitive driver, he can tell how the cars have improved through each version, which he nails brilliantly.
Yep. So, Lyndon, this is... I've been on a number of race car shoots, yeah. And three cars that are 30 odd years old or so on track at Donington. One driver or one journalist driver?
One journalist driver and one owner driver.
Okay.
The other was just delivered, shall we say.
So tell us, the behind the scenes stuff that goes into it, because they're wonderful pictures and they look beautifully composed and they look quite, the car looks mega, but the shots are quite calm. But I can imagine it was an absolute...
It was one of those, obviously, working with Dickie, saying, where are you going to do? How many laps are you going to drive each car for? To try and capture every car in the same place and get a cornering shot, a pan shot, and everything else was quite tricky. Thankfully, two cars came out at the same time. The first time they both came out, one was going at walking pace and did stop. But thankfully, we managed to get it back into the pits and repaired and back out on track. The nightmare that could have been was avoided, thankfully. It was handy. Dickie driving every car, knowing where I was and where he was going to put the car, made it a lot easier. And then obviously we were lucky enough to be on track at lunchtime, so we could do all the car to car and get all three cars on track with the owner drivers and mechanics driving.
Great stuff.
Well, you mentioned the opening shot, which is just one of the best pictures, I think, in the mag. How difficult was it to get that with all three cars together?
It was, obviously we had... it was handy. We had two proper racing drivers and a mechanic who was confident enough to get close enough to the car in front and to the camera car. And everybody followed my direction perfectly. So, yeah, we had a lap with all
really?
Three.
You don't have to be nice. You can tell, tell the truth.
No, everybody was following my hand signals and getting as close as I needed them. So you can tell who were the two drivers and who was a mechanic with distances. But I'm never going to get a car to try and drive into somebody else. It's always... millimeter perfect. So everybody, as long as people have faith in me and I have a bit of faith in the drivers, then we're happy.
No brake testing going on,
thankfully. Not although the boot lid of the BMW lead car did take a battering with the wind, so
that always happens. There's a shot on page 96, a sequence of shots on page 96 of the Bastos car having a lovely slide. We've also filmed, we did a kind of a reportage film of this day. So if you're listening to this, keep your eyes peeled on the Motorsport Magazine website, because we will be delivering some video on this, and there's some fabulous on board of Dickie getting this thing
drifting.
Very crossed up. Lovely story. So let's move on to another fantastic lunch. Now this is Simon's lunch with Mike Wilds, and Simon, over to you. To be honest, it's a great story, a great guy, works beautifully with this issue, with the balance of the issue. So tell us a little bit more about your lunch with Mike.
Yeah, it was. I thought he was a worthwhile subject, not perhaps the most obvious, because his Grand Prix career was short and a touch unsuccessful. But he's been racing for more than 50 years now. He did make Formula One. He was successful in the World Endurance Championship, and still nowadays, age 71, he's competing successfully in the Britcar Endurance Series and elsewhere. When I emailed him to ask whether he'd be interested in doing lunch, he called me back within about 15 seconds. I said, bloody hell, you must be hungry. And he was so... So not, I mean, he's got no side to him, Mike, at all. His feet are completely on the ground. And he was so, so flattered that we'd asked him whether he'd like to do it. And generally, the format with lunch is that we ask the guest to choose a pub or a restaurant of their choice. I won't say that money's no object, but we can be reasonably generous. We are allowed to be reasonably generous.
Oh, don't give that away.
but a lot of guests have very modest tastes, and Mike just wanted to go to a pub in Wiltshire, where he'd sadly lost his first wife a number of years ago to cancer, remarried very recently, and they had the wedding reception at the pub in Wiltshire, and he loves it to bits, and just said, well, could we, I mean, initially he said, initially he said he'd come to meet us in London. He offered to pay his own, he offered to, you know, pay for his own food. Yes, I mean, he said he'd pay his own way, and we said, no, we'll, you choose the pub, we'll come, we'll treat you. And so Lyndon and I made our way to Wiltshire and had a lovely, lovely lunch and the Royal Oak, and chatted to Mike for, I think the transcription was 2 hours and 55 minutes. Which took a while to unravel. But he's got a fund of lovely stories, because he came from racing in the 750 Motor Club, in what was called the 1172 Formula in those days. He bought his first racing car before he had a road car. He only had a bicycle at the time. He hadn't really thought things through very carefully. Setbacks by a couple of accidents and stuff early on. Then through a couple of lucky breaks, he managed to get onto the professional ladder. As I say, he got to Formula One. And then when that all fell apart, he managed to find a succession of drives in all sorts of things, and happily still racing today.
Still racing today, absolutely. And instructing as well.
He's been a helicopter instructor. One of the first jobs he got after his Formula One career ended in 75, a mate of his was running a helicopter business, and Mike said he knew nothing about helicopters at all. Didn't know how to fly one, didn't really know what they were, but he did his research. He became a very successful helicopter salesman, learned to fly one, and he has also been a qualified helicopter instructor, although where he's based in Wiltshire, it's easier for him to do motor racing instruction just because of the lack of available airfields nearby, but he does still keep his hand in with choppers as well.
I think one of the great things about this lunch is that it really just shows how motorsport has infused his life just so completely, and I think one story which I don't think made the final cut, but was how he met his first wife, who you mentioned, that he went to a race meeting with another girl, came off, when he came to, saw, and you'll tell the story better than I would, but saw another girl leaning over him, and that then became his wife, and he forgot all about the girl that he sort of took the race in the first place.
Yeah, that's a sort of condensed version. Yes, he took his girlfriend at the time to Brands Hatch. Ended up in hospital after a big accident at Brands Hatch. But between arriving and crashing, he'd started chatting up this other girl. And she when he did come to after a week or so, she was the one who was there in hospital when he woke up. And they did subsequently marry. And Mike told me that a couple of 3 years ago at Goodwood, he was standing in the paddock and a lady walked up to him and said, "Excuse me, are you Mike Wiles?" And it was girlfriend number one asking why he'd never called about 50-odd years ago. But no, I mean, there were lots of bits of Mike we could have we could probably have run the lunch to twice the length if we included everything he'd told us. But I hope people will enjoy the edited highlights.
We'll have to think of some way that we can offer the extended version, whether it's the text or the photography. You know, it's just there's obviously work ongoing with digital editions and things like that, but. Yeah, bear with us because there is so much content. You know, it's incredible, isn't it? If you think of the volume of content that we produce per issue, we pick the best, but there's probably still 40-50% that just can't make it.
Always the hardest part, isn't it? Deciding what goes in and what comes out, and yeah, a sort of director's cut, if you like, somewhere would be a great idea.
Extended version, yeah. Right, so moving on, let's go to Simon. This is another one of your features. You have had a busy month. So the Jaguar XJ220 has its 25th anniversary. Is that right? Yep. Simon, you went up to visit the Don Law's.
Yeah, Don Law Racing took over the responsibility for maintaining and servicing the XJ220. When I arrived in my cutting-edge Fiat Punto 1.4 16 valve sporting model, but when I arrived in my Punto in the leafy lanes of Staffordshire, I was very soon being towards where I was supposed to be meeting a group of other journalists. I found myself being followed by an XJ220, and I thought initially that my Punto's rearview mirror was playing tricks. Obviously I knew what I was going to see, but the fact it just suddenly loomed up behind me, I thought, wow. Yeah. And it is 25 years old, and part of the reason we did it is that I was one of a small group of journalists invited up to have a look at the Don Law facility. It's part of the build-up to this year's Silverstone Classic at the end of July, where there will be a parade. They're hoping the biggest ever parade of XJ220s, including three cars of the specification that raced at Le Mans in 1993, where they scored a class-winning 10th overall before the ACO and Tom Walkinshaw fell out and suddenly they weren't a class-winning 10th overall. But anyway, so we went up there to have a look at the facility and, I have to say, looking at the thing in my rearview mirror and subsequently on the ground, it doesn't look like a 25-year-old car in any way, shape or form. Not to my eyes. I mean, my eyes are a bit old and rubbish, but I still think it looks pretty damn near contemporary. It's an amazing looking thing.
Yeah.
And cars come from all around the world to Don Law's place, as he is the only kind of service centre. You can't really take it to Halfords or Quickfit. And there were 22 cars there at the time.
Really?
Plus a lot of his the other stuff that he looks after. People who know historic racing will have seen Justin Law, Don's son, racing all sorts of things in recent years. And they've got a litany of interesting cars there. I mean, there was a BMW M1 that took my eye, but I wasn't allowed to write about that because it was a Jaguar feature.
Next time.
Maybe. But it's a lovely looking car. And if you are going to the Silverstone Classic at the end of July, watch out for the parade because they're hoping to get 30 plus cars there.
I like to think that during that parade, up the front, there'll be a Fiat Punto. And there'll be all these cars trying to get past as they were on the lanes. So
there's a bit more space around Silverstone than there is on the leafy lanes of Staffordshire. But it's quite interesting that it's surreal almost that you go to rural Staffordshire. It's an area I know well. It's adjacent to Cheshire where I grew up, and there's this workshop just kind of set off to the side of a lane, and wander in, and there's so much fantastic automotive engineering.
It comes across in the story. It's a great piece, and the car has had a hell of a life. I think the fact that it was originally supposed to be V12, and customers got very upset when it went to a VC. I mean, this car is it's got a hell of an autobiography, and I think you've done a great job condensing it into this story. So So,
I was going to say, and also I just love the from the horse's mouth tale of its origin as a Saturday club, as something that the engineers did in their own time.
It was a real skunkworks project. Yeah. I mean, it was because Jagger would never have financed it, but by doing it in their own time and giving Jagger something, they giving them a car so good they really couldn't refuse it. But yeah, the development costs were to Jaguar were pretty much nil.
Yeah, and interesting. I mean, the SVO setup now over at Jaguar Land Rover, they hate the phrase skunk works. They think they're much more than that. But it has I've been over there, and it's a similar vibe, I would imagine, to when the XJ220 was created. You know, the work that they're doing over there is pretty extraordinary at the moment, and it feels like they've given certain people within the business the creativity and the freedom to kind of express some really fabulous ideas, you know. So it's nice to see that it lives on in a way.
And I used the phrase skunk works because that was the phrase that Absolutely. Keith Helbert, who designed the thing, came up with. I mean, that was his term.
Suits it beautifully. Okay, so let's move on now. There's the Hall of Fame. So we had a fantastic Hall of Fame this year. You may have heard a lot about this already. There's been some great photography, some fun video on our website. It was a great event, and I won't say much more about it. I would advise you to go and have a look at our website for some even more images from it. But great night, chaps. Do you enjoy yourself?
A fantastic time. I mean, it's just always such a treat to sort of be in the same room and get the chance to talk to people who you'd never think that you'd get the chance to talk to. And I thought this year especially was great. And I've got to mention the Nigel Mansell and Murray Walker
double. Go for it.
I mean, absolute showstopper when they came up to accept Nigel's prize, which Murray gave to him. No, I got that wrong, didn't I?
Yeah, it was the other way around.
Nigel, we asked him not to give it away. He did.
Someone else gave Nigel his prize.
Sir Patrick Head, who presented Nigel, and like Murray and Nigel, Patrick and Nigel were a great, great double act. And as it is, as you say, it's lovely to, I mean, it's obviously a privilege to be part of the team that's involved in promoting the event. But it's the reaction, the response of the people who come along. I mean, Murray, he won't mind me saying, he's now 93 and a half. And getting out to events is not the work of a moment for him. But I sat next to him, known him for 30-odd years. And he had such a fantastic... I know he emailed the office with his thanks, as a lot of other people have, but he just had such a fantastic time. And it's the response of the guests that makes it worthwhile to me. Obviously, we're slightly impartial because we're involved. But when you actually see the effect it has on the guests and how much they enjoy themselves, to me, that's the key.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, Lyndon, there as well. It was your first Hall of Fame. You were in the thick of it, weren't you?
It was, and going on from what Simon was saying about the people that are there, it's so exciting to see people who are like your heroes meet their heroes, you know, like with Tom Christensen meeting Brian Redman, and just seeing how excited everybody is to be there, and the whole event, you know, like I say, it was our first time, but you're rushed off your feet, but it is also a really relaxing and great atmosphere to be part of.
Yeah, it's very, very, you know, I guess we would say that, but you know, we'd love to be able to, you know, teleport our readers into it, you know, and hopefully we'll be doing that with some videos and some more footage on the website over the next few weeks or so. But I pinched myself on a few occasions. It really was.
Well, taking your selfie of you and Nigel.
Oh,
was,
the Oscar
was the highlight.
Selfie. Yeah, that was. I felt slightly embarrassed doing it, but we're all there backstage. John Watson, Dario, Tom Christensen, Nigel Mansell, and then Jenny and myself. And I just, I'm sorry, guys. And Nigel was getting his microphone set up and everything. I said, look, I've got to do this. I'm really sorry. And I did a selfie. So that's on our Motorsport Magazine Twitter feed and my Twitter feed as well. So that's one for the wall.
Yep. Next
So, okay, moving on now. So, so we've looked at IndyCar and, in particular, the evolution of the car itself in from a safety perspective, because we've had some dramatic incidents and accidents recently in IndyCar, and while there's been some bumps and bruises, and from Sebastian Bourdais' perspective, I think a broken pelvis, the accidents that we've seen would have been fatal not so long ago. So we wanted to have a look at how a driver, in particular how Sebastian Bourdais, can survive an accident like this. And I think our writer, John Oriovitz, or Oreo Biscuits, as he's been nicknamed in the office, has done a really good job. I think he's done a great job, Joe.
He's done a great job, and he's got great access. He obviously knows. I mean, we all sort of follow it, but he is a US-based journalist. He follows IndyCar, and he can talk to all the right people, which really comes across in this piece. And he talks very insightfully about first of all about the accidents that have happened and why they happened, and then what the series has done to try and make things much safer. I mean, as well as people surviving some of these terrible accidents, what comes across is the fact that, you know, there have been some really very nasty crashes, especially when compared to Formula One over recent years, in IndyCar. So I think it's a really timely piece, and it's, you know, well put together, and it makes for sobering but very interesting reading, I think.
Yeah, and the IndyCar, you know, they're fully committed with the next generation vehicle to ensure that safety is improved all the way, you know, along the way. So it's yeah. Simon, did you want to?
Yeah, I have to confess, I haven't yet read the feature because I was elsewhere when that part of the mag was being put together. But I was listening to IndyCar radio during qualifying when Bourdais had his accident. I know Sebastian pretty well. I've worked with him in Formula 3000 and F1 and stuff in the past. And I was pleased that I heard the accident rather than seeing it, because when I did subsequently see a replay, I think it was pretty brutal. And I've lost a couple of drivers to whom I've been close in IndyCar accidents. Gonzalo Rodriguez in 1999. And Justin Wilson in 2015. The racing's very exciting. I do sometimes wish that they'd, you know, it wasn't quite as hazardous as it sometimes appears to be. But I'm very relieved that Sebastian got away with what are relatively light injuries. I know that he put something up on Twitter a couple of days later saying he wasn't going out for a run that afternoon, but he was heading in the right direction, and I'm looking forward to reading it, and I'm pleased to see that measures are being taken to reduce the casualty count, because, you know, from personal experience of I have been a little bit too close to a couple of tragedies.
Let's take a look now at the. We have a photo essay following the IndyCar story. Now this is a surprise and delight.
This
feature.
Is one of the best things in the magazine. You this can't not like slot cars.
Simon
you just
had his way. This would be the cover story, wouldn't it? Slot car.
Maybe a Capri slot car. Mansell or an SD1. Mansell's FW14B versus slot car racing. It's a tough call. But I have to say, Lyndon, this is all your handiwork, and I think the images are great, absolutely lovely, and the story, the accompanying story, is wonderful as well.
Tell us more about it, Lyndon. Tell us about the day. Tell us. I mean, you must have had a whale of a time.
It kind of followed on from my Wimbledon essay, and we were thinking of what other strange or unusual events we could go to, and thankfully there was the Slot Car Festival at Gaydon, so a couple of emails, and I was in. it was such a big kids day. It was fantastic. I went with a friend of mine, and I have to say, we did get rather caught up on the drag strip.
Okay, tell us more.
With our reaction times, and it did turn into quite a big competition of just trying to beat the green light and beat each other. But
this is one. There's a shot, isn't there? Page 136. It crosses over 136, 137. I think where you can see.
There's a young girl and boy playing with it. Yeah, yeah. It's also on 135 where you've got the staging lights.
135, yeah.
But it was just one of those days where you see ages from 5 to 50 and beyond of people. Everybody's had a slot car. Everybody's had Sky Electrics. Everybody's had the Aurora. And it was self-indulgent, basically. And I got some good photos.
Well, I think the reader will get a lot out of this. I mean, the Tamir story we did a couple of months ago, the Slot Car Festival, Wimbledon, you know, all of these things kind of form our love of racing. It's not, you know, it's not just Formula One. It's not just Capri, Simon. You know, there are slot cars and models.
There's Alton Park as well.
And there's Alton Park. So we're going to continue with this, aren't we, Joe? This the weird and wonderful type feature every issue.
You know, I mean, Lyndon's nickname in the office now is Annie, as in Annie Leibovitz. He's made a niche for himself to do these fantastic kind of photo essays, which really get under the skin of sort of unusual and delightful and lovely kind of events that are going on all the time. And this is a great example. And actually, the other thing about slot cars is that the wonderfully named Julie Scale, owner of Scale Models, who is one of the people who puts this event on, made the point that it crosses the generation, so you can get grandparents playing with grandchildren and you know, the son in the middle kind of thing. So you've got it's not like sort of other types of sport or even computer games, which maybe the granddad might not sort of fully understand or be able to play. It plays across generations, and that's what made it such a lovely event.
Which is harder to get accreditation for, the Monaco Grand Prix or the UK Slot Car Festival?
Definitely Monaco Grand Prix. I mean, you know, like I said, a couple of emails to Julie and I was in.
Oh, that's brilliant. I hope they like this story. I get a sense of pride when we're able to reflect people's passion in this way, and I think you've done a really good job.
And there was the British Championship there, and just watching the determination and the way people were behind the scenes setting their cars up for the races, it was like being back in another paddock, but just 1/32nd scale.
Fabulous.
Except at the end of the drag race, to stop the cars, there's a cardboard box full of styrofoam.
What's it?
High tech only goes so far.
There's no parachutes. Yeah.
Oh, that would be cool though, wouldn't it? Little scale
parachutes. 1/32nd scale parachutes. Yeah.
Listen, guys, we are running out of time, sadly. I hope as if you're listening to this, I really hope you've enjoyed it, and I hope you've enjoyed the way we've been able to talk through some of the features in the magazine. As I say, this is the August 2017 issue commentary of Motorsport. Please check out, if you haven't got a copy already, please check it out in all good news agents in the States and Barnes & Noble, Australia. It's all over the place. The digital edition too. Check out Motorsport Magazine's website for more information. Is there anything else, guys, you want to add? What slipped through the net this month? What haven't we talked about?
I might just mention Simon's maiden trip to the Isle of Man, and he came
of back course.
Kicking himself that he's waited so long to go over there and watch the racing.
Yeah, I have to say that was a real treat. Now, it's something I've wanted to go and watch. I know I'm supposed to write about cars rather than bikes, but I do like watching bikes. It's something I wanted to do for years and years and years and years and years. This year, Dunlop very kindly invited me to join them. And why have I waited? I could have gone 50 odd years ago. Why didn't I? It's if you haven't done it, you should. And I know that people talk about the safety. I'm going back into the tragedies again now, but I know people talk about the safety aspect, but nobody is holding a gun to anyone's head and making these guys go and do this, guys and girls. Typical British superbike race, you get 25, 26 bikes. On the Isle of Man, you get 70. Typically in the UK, if you see a sidecar race, if it's a national event, you might get 20, 22 outfits. Isle of Man, there are about 40. I think the numbers tell their own story. You know, people want to do this event. They love the challenge. And it was fascinating to mingle, to have the privilege of mingling in the paddock, just being up close to guys like Michael Dunlop, William Dunlop, Peter Hickman, before they got on their bikes to go out and take part in the TT. Just being, I can feel the asthma back in my start to stand. Yeah, absolutely. But just standing there and watching them, they all react in different ways. Some of them are cut off, isolated. Others see you standing there with a camera and they turn and smile and wave at you, and even though they've no idea who you are. It's just, oh, just such an all-consuming event.
I think we should all agree to go next year.
Yes.
I think just we'll get a group of us together and we'll go. Maybe if we quit, and I've been a couple of times, hired a bungalow with some mates, and that's probably the way we should
You've
do it.
You've ridden
next
a
year.
Bike around the course.
I have ridden a bike around there, yeah. Yeah, I managed to survive that and nearly not survive a 30 mile an hour on the road, but I absolutely loved it. So
being married to a Manx girl, it does it holds a special place to my heart as well.
Oh, there's a revelation in this podcast. I wasn't aware of that.
We could go and stay at your in-laws.
Stay at the mother-in-laws, yeah. Space.
Okay, right, we're booked in. Listen, I'll quickly run through what else is in this issue and then we'll call it time. So we have Formula One Frontline with Mark Hughes. He's dissected the McLaren crisis. That's on page 33. International news, GT3 news, historic news, rallying news, events of the month. We have our columnist, Dickie Mead and Richard Williams, another fantastic column from Matt Oxley. And then we have road car news, road tests, letters, a good You Were There this month. Simon's fantastic column about the TT. More great stuff from Gordon and Doug Nye from the archive side of things. And the parting shot on page 192. We'll be back in around 4 weeks, I should think. So around the end of July, dissecting the September 2017 issue of Motorsport. I hope you can join us. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
Thank you, Simon.
Thank you.
And thanks to Lyndon.
Thank you.
Yeah, stay tuned. We'll see.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
See you next time.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.